Coming up today, what a treat I have in store for you. Brett Coleman, you know him from the Film Room YouTube channel, the Bootleg Football Podcast. He is one of the premier NFL content creators out there. Coming on the show today to give his thoughts on what he sees the Seahawks building, what he liked about what they did in the draft, and in particular, a certain guy on day three that he really, really loved the selection of, what he feels about the rest of the division and how all of the Seahawks opponents drafted, and much, much more. Brett Coleman joins me next.
Welcome to the Seahawks Forever Podcast, in-depth analysis on everything Seahawks. And now, here's your host, Dan Viens.
Don't want to waste any time, so let's get all the business out of the way. Be sure to hit that thumbs up, that like button on the YouTube channel, subscribe to the channel, and hit that bell so you don't ever miss any future notifications of future episodes. That's how the verbiage works. If you prefer audio content, you can subscribe for a low monthly fee on Spotify and listen to ad-free episodes. Otherwise, you can hear the show on whichever podcast platform you prefer. And if you want to just support me in the show, you can buy me a coffee or hit that super thanks down below. Let's get into it. Brett Coleman, nice enough to take some time out of his busy schedule to join me today. Here's our conversation. Brett, thanks for joining me on the show. You were describing to me before I hit record how busy this time of year is for you. I can only imagine. Hopefully, you've got some vacation lined up the rest of this month.
Eventually, you know, you still got all the post-draft work to do. And then, you know, once you get to like mid to late May, that's when the NFL world kind of goes away for a little while.
We're going to talk about the draft, obviously, not just the Seahawks, but your thoughts on the rest of the division. This is draft grade territory, as you touched on. What are your feelings about that? Do you enjoy that process and just that concept? Or is it just sort of fall into the category of necessary evil?
It's tough to put a letter grade on things because every single pick, or almost every single pick, is justifiable for one reason or another. So like very rarely would I ever give somebody like a negative grade on a draft, because short of doing something completely nonsensical with like a premium asset, every single pick is explainable, and especially for the Seahawks too. I didn't really know what they were going to do going into the draft. Nobody did, because they were one of the more flexible teams, picking in the middle of the first round with a few different needs that are wildly different that they could have gone. But all of them were justifiable. There wasn't like a right answer for Seattle. Like I gave them Graham Barton. They ended up with Byron Murphy.
Yeah.
Both picks would have made sense. Like you could have justified Troy Fautanu. You could have justified, Quinyon Mitchell. Like there's a bunch of different guys that you could have argued for. So I don't focus as much on grades, because I feel like it actively encourages people to not look at the process from the team's perspective. And instead, it makes people look at the process from an outsider's perspective, using like consensus boards or rankings or something like that. When it's like, if you're really diving in and you're looking at what the team itself was trying to do, pretty much everything makes sense for all these clubs.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because a lot of fans would disagree with you. You know, the reaction that I see on Twitter to some of the, especially some of the day three picks the Seahawks had this year, and this happens every year at some point in the draft, is if they don't know the player, or they haven't previously decided they like the player or think that that's who they should select, then it's a bad pick. And I'm thinking about the Tyrese Knight pick. There were a lot of people that just, they look at the consensus big board and they see that he's projected to be a fifth or sixth round pick. The Seahawks take him in the fourth. So it's a bad pick. Heading into this, and you touched on it, and when you and I first touched base a few weeks ago, you said you were fascinated to see what they would do in the first round. And you even mentioned in your mock draft show where you had them taking Graham Barton that it might've been the most confusing of all the first round picks. Are you starting to see now, kind of 4 months into this thing, now that we have a little bit more data of how they're trying to build this under Mike McDonald, are you starting to see sort of an identity come together and some clues of what type of team they're trying to build?
It certainly does feel Ravens-ish, right? And I think with the Byron Murphy pick, Mike McDonald was trying to find his Justin Matabuike.
Yeah.
Like that's what he was looking for. They've got like nine edges at this point. Like, yeah. But they really need the interior guy. Like they really need somebody who is going to just slash through the middle of the offensive line and just mess stuff up, you know, make quarterbacks have to step into the edges that they've invested so much in the last like 3 years straight. Before this one, I think they added an edge rusher of some kind, whether it's in the draft or free agency.
Yeah.
And so now they were trying to get the real difference maker, just like in Baltimore, Matabuike was the difference maker for a mm-hmm. lot of those collection, you know, the Island of Misfit Toys edges they had there in Baltimore last year, like Kyle Van Noy and Jadeveon Clowney.
Yeah.
It all worked because they had Matabuike. And I think that's what Mike McDonald recognized is like, interior pressure is what makes this thing go. And they were not going to leave the first two rounds without one. And they got arguably the best in this class. So it was a good pick for them. Completely understood the process at the time. And I don't know what the Seahawks fan reaction to it was, but I hope it was excitement.
I think universally it was the pick at that moment, other than Troy Fatanu, who's a local favorite, played at UW, and that interior offensive line was perceived as the biggest need by most. Outside of that selection, I think it's universally accepted. It's the first pick I can remember in a long time. Even last year, Devin Witherspoon was met with some polarity because there were those who thought it's too high to take a corner, especially a guy who might play inside. So no, it was loved here. What is it specifically about Murphy that you think that makes you think he can be that dude?
Explosiveness and lateral agility. You know, the thing that made Matabuike work was the first step was so ferocious, right? You know, he could cross the face of a guard instantly. And even if he's lined up as a loose three, he can end up in the A gap instantly. And there's nothing the guard could do about it. So you better slide his way to have the center help out so that, you know, there's somebody who can kind of rebound him back into the guard. Because if it's one-on-one, he's got a two-way go, you're kind of screwed. And I think Byron Murphy has that similar kind of first step where there's the gap he's lined up in and the gap he ends up in. And he's explosive enough to completely change that picture on your post-snap. So you better slide his way, which means you're giving everybody else one-on-ones. And knowing Mike McDonald, if you're sliding one way the entire game, he's going to abuse the other side with like stunts and games and all that kind of stuff that are really hard to handle with even numbers. So he's I think Byron Murphy's a force multiplier in a scheme sense. And we're going to see the effect of that fairly quickly.
And then, of course, the Seahawks didn't ignore the interior offensive line, even though they chose not to go that way early. And that was commonly perceived as the biggest need in this draft. For good reason. They go Christian Haynes. They don't make any moves. You know, there was a lot of thought going into day two. They would do something to get up into that range that John Schneider just couldn't, you know, live with himself watching 64 picks pass by. And yet they do. And they wait until 81. And Christian Haynes falls into their lap, a guy that was projected to go in the 50s by most boards. And then they go LeMaia later in the draft out of Utah, another guy that was projected by most to go a round or two earlier. And then shortly before the draft, they added Laken Tomlinson, who knows how much he has left in the tank. Do you feel like they did enough to address that spot?
I do because of how much I love the Haynes pick. And I said it the day that he was taken on Twitter. I thought Christian Haynes was one of the best value picks that any team made in the draft up to that point. Like we're talking about a rock solid guard who is one of the most gifted run blockers specifically for zone based systems in this entire class. He might be the best overall zone blocker at any position in this class. And if you're looking at, you know, the addition of Laken Tomlinson, the drafting of Christian Haynes, this all screams we're running wide zone this year. Like this is what we're doing. Buckle up. And if you're going to do that, you know, with Ryan Grubb, if you're going to do that, you better have Christian Haynes, because as far as agility and fluidity to pick off linebackers on the second level, to be a great blocker in space, somebody whose first step is absolutely elite and can reach block three techniques on his own, you know, doesn't need that help from the tackle. Like they can let the tackle go Christian's like, all right, I got this. Like, we talk about Byron Murphy being a force multiplier on the defensive line. I think Christian Haynes is a force multiplier for the offensive line because of the things he can do athletically. He's just not normal. And I compared him to Brandon Brooks, who was also a third round pick at one point. 13 years ago at this point, 12 years ago at this point.
Yeah.
And Brooks was similarly built, similarly athletic, and similarly dominant on those types of runs. Love that pick. And I think he's going to start. I really do. Like day one, no doubt about it. I think they drafted a starter in the third round, which is all you can really hope for.
They did it 4-5 years ago. They took Damian Lewis in the third round and he started from day one as a rookie and they got 4 good years out of him. And then he, you know, before they let him walk in free agency. It was fun to listen to, who was it? Braden Fisk saw an interview with him the other day and he was asked who was the guy at the Senior Bowl that gave him the most trouble. And he spent a minute and a half talking about what a badass Christian Haynes was. The thought there again, so the Seahawks go 2 days into the draft and everyone here is happy. Like they two biggest boxes, check and check. Then they go into day three and they kind of acted like the old Seahawks that we're used to, where they're taking guys that we're not expecting and position groups we're not expecting. They double dip on Auburn corners when it was felt like that wasn't really a pressing need. Anything stand out to you at all about what they did on day three?
Ironically, the second corner they took, DJ James, I liked a lot better than the first corner they took.
He was rated higher by most, yeah.
I really like DJ James. I can't remember if there was like an injury issue or something like that, but the tape is really good, like really, really good. So as far as like dime corner goes, because like they're already pretty good at corner, like decently good at corner. Well, more than decently good. You got Reek, you got Witherspoon. They're good at corner. But right. As far as somebody who can come in, be an immediate dime corner for you, maybe even challenge to be the third corner in nickel looks, like I think DJ James has a better chance of doing that than Pritchett at this point. So in my head canon, I kind of just flip those picks around. But we know Mike McDonald, he's going to live in nickel a lot. So you better have a bunch of good corners if you're going to do that. Because if somebody goes down, you need somebody else who could play. I honestly kind of liked what they did on day three. Was it chalky? Absolutely not. But did it make sense? Yes. Like Barner, like we need a new blocking tight end.
Yeah.
We're going to run the ball a lot. Like we need a guy who can do it. So process wise, it all made sense. Even if it wasn't what we expected, I still liked it.
Well, and even the night selection, I think, again, that one might have been a victim of, you know, as fans who follow the draft, and everyone does now because it's accessible to everyone, they can only follow the information that's out there. And when they see a guy that's projected to be a 6th, 7th rounder, maybe an undrafted free agent, and he goes in the 4th, that's all they have to work with. To me, my immediate reaction to it was, well, wait a second. You just hired a guy who has built a reputation as being one of the sharpest young defensive minds in the league, and a guy who has made his hay from the linebacker position. We should probably trust Mike McDonald's input on this pick, right?
I think when he looked at Tyrese Knight, he saw somebody who he thinks can be his new like Tyus Bowser or Kyle Van Noy type. Like, does he play edge? Does he play off ball linebacker? Yeah. Yes. What is he? All of it. They'll figure it out. But like, I think that's what he saw. He saw a ball of clay that he might be able to mold into that. I don't want to say like narrow role player, because he does play a little bit of everything, but he's not like committed to one position. He's a package player, but a good package player. And I think that's what Mike McDonald saw. Is like, I've always had this kind of key component to my defense, somebody who is kind of like a versatile Sam linebacker type who we can either put on the ball or off the ball. We don't have that right now. Well, I think Nwosu could, but again, he's coming off injury, so yeah. We'll see. But other than that, he's like, I don't know if we have that on the roster, so let me just make sure I got it.
Interesting. Yeah, especially given that he played outside linebacker his first 3 years, and then they just moved him to inside linebacker this last year. It reminds me a little bit of when they took Jordan Brooks. It was the same thing. They had just moved him to Mike after playing Will for 3 years, and so people weren't sure what to make of him. But the upside seems to be pretty clear there. I want to kind of get your thoughts on a couple other things. As someone from that pays attention to the whole league, the outside looking in. One storyline of local interest here, obviously, is what happened to, or what was going to happen heading into the draft, Michael Penix Jr. And there was even quite a bit of mystery surrounding what would happen if he was on the board at 16. He goes 8 to Atlanta. There was some buzz right before the draft that that might happen, but it wasn't until the name was announced that everybody, it kind of sank in. And there's been a lot of opinion out there on either side of the ledger. Where do you fall on what Atlanta did there taking Penix when they had just signed Cousins?
Oh man, there's so much to say. For me, the only reason that I could really come up with, and it's a twofold reason of why you make that pick. Number one, the Kirk Cousins deal is effectively 2 years if you're looking at the guarantee structure, as in they can get out of it after 2025, and especially post June 1, 2025, they can get out of it without really having that bad of a cap hit, at least not by like modern quarterback dead money standards, right? Where it's like $80 million or whatever it was for Russ.
Right.
It's like not that bad after 2 years. And so if you're looking at Kirk, who I think at that time is going to be 37 or 38, they were already thinking about having a succession plan in place for 2027 anyway, or 2026 anyway. And I think they were originally planning on doing that next year. However, I think that they think they won't have a first round pick next year because of the tampering thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
There was buzz before the draft that the league was going to bump them from 8 to 32 and have that be the punishment. And then of course the league came out and said, we're not going to do anything this year. There's not enough time. We haven't decided yet. And they weren't going to like do it the day before the draft. Right. And throw a huge wrench into everything. But I think Atlanta thinks they're not going to have a first next year. And for me, I think that kind of sped up their clock where they already liked Penix a lot. But I think their process was, okay, if we're not going to get one next year and we need one for 2026, we might as well bite the bullet and do it now, because the depth in next year's quarterback class isn't super great. And we don't think we're going to get like the talented guy that's falling to the second round, like a Will Levis type. With like, we don't think we're going to get that next year. So we kind of have to do it now, bite the bullet. And yes, Kirk is going to be pissed off, but if Kirk's only here for 2 years anyway, whereas Penix might be here for 10, we'll take the 8, right? So that was kind of the only reason I could come up with. And it doesn't feel great, but it's the only thing I could really think of to justify it.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see how that one plays out. I don't mind a pissed off Kirk Cousins. I kind of like seeing him pissed off.
He plays better when he's pissed off. Yeah,
and he's so well behaved all the time anyway. It's kind of nice to see him have a little edge to him. Looking around the division, this is what I'm really interested to dig into a little bit with you, because as a Seahawk fan, I try to be unbiased in evaluating the opponents in the division, but it's, you know, at the end of the day, it's a little bit harder and you kind of see what you want to see. I kind of like what every team did in the division on draft day and on the 3 days of the draft, and even in some of the undrafted moves, especially one team in particular just kept taking dudes that I had mocked many, many times to the Seahawks. Who stands out to you from the division and what they did in the draft?
I'll tell you what. I think in terms of just pure good players in a vacuum, San Francisco took the best players because I love the – well, Arizona is cheating. They took Marvin. So we'll grade this on a curve.
And they had like 25 picks too. So
yeah, we'll grade this on a curve. Yeah. So given the resources available, I thought who picked the best players with the limited resources they had, it would be San Francisco. I love the Renardo Green pick. Pearsall pick didn't make as much sense to me at first, but then I realized like, oh, okay, one of these guys getting traded.
Right.
Pearsall kind of fits what Kyle, when you're looking at the process from the team's perspective, you're like, all right, I get it. The Isaac Rendo pick in the fourth, like I really love the Pooney pick in the third, like they picked great players, but I still keep going back to the Rams draft.
Yeah.
Because you see identity, you see identity in this class of like, okay, we have 1,000 pounds collectively in our interior offensive line trio. We have not one, not two, but three backs, if you're adding in Blake Corum, that excel in just downhill gap scheme runs, right? We have all these receivers that just block the hell out of people. They're going to run the ball 35 times a game. Like, that's what the Rams are going to do. And they're going to make you get into single high looks and then hit you with endless crossing routes with Kupp and Puka. Like, they are going to be a nightmare to prepare against. And I'll tell you what, if you go back to last year, like, Mike McDonald, I think, was the best DC in the league last year. If you watch the Rams-Ravens game, the first series from the Rams offense, they ran it over and over and over again. And it was the only time that I saw somebody get the best of Mike, where McVay, yeah, like, you could see McVay was like looking at him on the sidelines of like, I got you. I know what you're doing. I know how you're using Hamilton. I know how I can use motion to spin guys out and get the exact looks that I need for this run game. They ran it like 8 times in a row. And you could see McVay was like, I got you, Mike. And Mike adjusted throughout the game. It was honestly like an amazing like coach versus coach battle that like nobody paid attention to. But I had a blast watching that All-22 because I could see what McVay was doing and I could see how Mike was countering it. And the fact that we're getting that twice a year now, amazing defensive mind versus brilliant offensive mind, like, they're loading up for each other. Like, like people talk about Seahawks, Niners as like the rivalry. I'm telling you what, for like degenerate ball knowers, Rams Seahawks is going to be the game this year. That's going to be like the ultimate coach tape that I will be tuned in. Like, I don't even care if I'm covering the game that week. I'm watching those matchups because of how those guys were doing battle from a schematic perspective last year and how they've spent this entire offseason building to counter each other. It's amazing. I cannot wait.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought you'd say. And I was afraid you'd say, because that's, I felt the same way. It's that, you know, heading this time a year ago, you know, when Pete Carroll was still running the Seahawks and we thought we were on the edge of contention. You even did a video on your channel 13, 14 months ago about the Seahawks Super Bowl window. It's how much things change, right? And then looking at the Rams at that time, going into last season, we thought, well, the offense is going to be pretty good if Stafford's healthy, but that defense is Aaron Donald and 10 dudes. Like, they just didn't seem to have an identity, to borrow your word. And then they go out and the defense is much better than anyone expected. And they end up winning 10 games and making the playoffs. And then they go out and address maybe their biggest weakness in the offseason and loading up on the interior offensive line. So that's scary. And then they go out in the draft and they just draft a bunch of ass kickers. Like, I'm even a big fan. I went to WSU, but Brennan Jackson was a guy I liked on day three and thought he was being woefully underregarded. And they even added him to Verse and Fisk and some guys that I just love. So I think, you know, if I'm doing picks today, are the Rams the best team in the division?
They're who I'm going to pick to win it.
Yeah.
You know, which, here's the thing. I still have the Seahawks going to the playoffs. And I still have the Niners going to the playoffs. That's how good the NFC West is. And honestly, the Cardinals are going to fight for a 7 seed. But I've got 3 teams out of this division going to the playoffs. That's how good they are. Yeah. Is that I still think the Rams are going to win it. And they got 2 teams that are going to be 10 plus wins.
Let's talk about the Cardinals for a minute, because I don't want to dismiss them. You know, they clearly, I mean, ever since I saw the video everybody saw last year of Monty Austin Fort moving up, trying to move up in the board and up and down, and some of those war room shots that just show how quick on his feet he is and what a thinker he is. I like what he's doing there, but they've clearly hitched their wagon to Kyler Murray. And how they do over the next couple of years is going to depend on how he performs and if he can really step up and establish himself as that guy. Where do you land on Kyler Murray? Do you believe he is that special guy that can be a franchise quarterback, or is that a little bit of a shaky ground for them to build things on?
I think there's a fine line between franchise quarterback and like top 10 quarterback or even top 8 quarterback. Like, it's so funny. The closer you get to the top 5, the more distance there is between individual numbers, right?
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, inarguably top 5 right now, like, yes, Mahomes is in it. Allen is in it. Burrow's in it. Lamar's in it. And then once you get to 5, it's between a bunch of different guys. But once you get to eight, like the gap between eight and nine is a lot bigger than the gap between seven and five. The gap between nine and 10 is bigger still. And I think it's so interesting how we have a bunch of like elite quarterbacks. And then there's kind of this snowman's land of like good quarterbacks. And then once you get to like 18, it starts to fall off a cliff.
Yeah.
And it feels like there's a lot of great quarterbacks in the NFL right now. And there is, but boy, there's a shelf. There's a shelf. And I think Kyler's in kind of like that no man's land area where it's like, yes, good, well above average, not in the conversation of like the top eight for me. And I would also put Geno in that area
too. I was just going to ask, where does he fit into that ranking for you?
Right. But Stafford is in that conversation of like top eight.
Is
Brock Purdy? He's kind of in that top of the no man's land, you know, like 10, 11, somewhere around there, but still not. That's the thing. It's like Brock Purdy, who was in MVP contention for a lot of last year. I still think there's a bigger gap between Stafford and Purdy than there is between Stafford and like Burrow. Hmm. Like that's how tight that group is at the top.
Yeah. A lot of buzz, even the last couple of days, will not go away here in Seattle. And every time you think it's gone away, because the draft is over now, it's, you know, then there's a report yesterday that Pittsburgh was calling around or is still calling around, trying to trade for a playmaker, for a receiver, and some speculation that maybe they checked in on DK Metcalf. There is a segment of this fan base that wants DK to be traded. And there's even a prominent local radio host who will not stop talking about it.
No.
Would that be nuts?
Is that nuts? No, you don't want DK traded.
Yeah.
You don't want that.
Is he an elite receiver?
He's better than anything else they're going to get right now. And here's the thing. He plays his role. He is that big ass-kicking X receiver who two or three times a game you're going to take shots to, and he's going to either score or flip the field. And the NFL is won and lost on explosive plays. Lockett can still give you that as well, but he's, you know, again, father time is undefeated.
Right.
And DK is going to be able to do that for longer. And I love JSN, but JSN's the guy you throw to on third down when you need to move the chains. DK's the guy you throw to on second and three when we need to score. So, no, I'm not trading DK, because where are they going to get that right now?
Yeah.
Like, what else are they going to do to get that kind of field flipping explosiveness? Like, they couldn't do it in the draft this year. So, like, what's the plan to replace DK Metcalf? And then let's say you do trade DK and you get like a future one or something like that. What happens if Tyler goes down? You're building your entire passing offense out of JSN. And yeah. I love JSN, but like, he can't do it by himself. I don't know. I feel like fans sometimes don't realize how good they have it until you look at, like, you know, the Panthers receiving core last year. Like, they would have gnawed off their own leg to have DK. Like, I don't know. Sometimes just understand that you got it good and live the high life, man.
Music to my ears. It's what I've been trying to tell people, but I think they're going to listen to you.
I just think if you have good players, don't go out of your way to get rid of good players.
That's, yeah. And it's the hardest thing to get. The late, great John Clayton used to always refer to the NFL as a talent acquisition league, that usually, for the most part, the teams with the most talent win. And when you have a talent like DK Metcalf, I think it's a fantasy football mentality, though, right? Fans can, we can all go on over the cap now. We can play with the calculator. We can build our dream roster. I have one guy in particular who's a loyal viewer and follower, and we interact on Twitter all the time. And he proposes things to me every day that are essentially piecing together an all-star team by trading for all the other team's best players.
Oh, if only it was that easy.
If only.
I just think if you're getting an asset for DK Metcalf, what do you think the odds are that you're getting a player as good as DK Metcalf? I would say it's pretty low.
Yeah. And plus, I don't know. I know it's only been a couple of years since Tyreek got a first and more, and AJ Brown got a first and more. I would argue that that wide receiver market has changed. You know, so many guys now, every single year we hear about, this is the best wide receiver class we've seen in years. I mean, it's just with what college offenses are doing now, it's every year now you can get receivers and the learning curve doesn't seem to be as steep as it used to be. John Schneider used to even say it's tough to draft receivers and expect them to contribute much for their first two or three years in the league. I don't think that's the case anymore. So I'm not sure that, I don't know if DK, someone like DK is going to get you a first round pick anymore. I just don't know if the markets are.
Let me put it this way. The Titans traded AJ Brown because they thought they could do it again. Look where that got them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't want to be out here, man. It's hard out here. Just like enjoy having good players. Yeah. Like you don't want to try to replace them.
Well, and it's so hard to replace. And that comes up in the quarterback conversation around here all the time. Like, okay, you don't like Geno. Who's better? And can you get him? And the answer is usually no. Like, unless, we'll just draft a guy. Yeah, because that always works out.
And I mean, a lot of fans were thinking like, we'll be able to get Michael Penix. No, you couldn't.
Right. Yeah. You couldn't even get Bo Nix.
You got nothing.
You couldn't even get Bo Nix
before you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's a hard league, man. It's a hard league.
Yeah. You've got some cool things coming up on your content. The Brett Coleman channel, the film room, and also the Bootleg Football podcast. And you have mentioned a new program in the last couple of weeks. Has you really excited about the future of content creation? What do you got coming up?
Yeah, so I'm working with the NFL now as part of their Access Pass program, which is basically their way of just establishing a line of communication with creators and giving them the resources and access they need to just make cool stuff. And so my particular relationship with the NFL, you know, obviously I do like all 22 based content, and they have every scrap of NFL all 22 going back to 2002. And it's, you know, recently digitized out of the vault. So it's available now.
Yeah.
And so I'm just putting in like wild requests for stuff of like, I want to do a video on, you know, the 2010 to 2013 49ers linebacking corps where they had like four all pros. You know, I want to do a video on like 2006 Bob Sanders. I want to do a video comparing Marvin Jr., Marvin Sr. And they just keep sending me all this all 22. So it's been fun, you know, kind of looking back at all this vintage stuff from literally decades ago now.
Nice.
And just kind of imagining all the content I can make about it over summer. I'll ask you this as a Seahawks fan, early to mid 2000s Seahawks topics. If you were going to have like your dream vintage Seahawks video, who would it be about?
God, you know what? The first thing that popped into my head was, you know, that the left side of the offensive line, Walter Jones, Steve Hutchinson, was one of the best combinations of all time. But then immediately followed by, I always thought Matt Hasselbeck was one of the most underrated quarterbacks in the league during that time. And that he did some really, really cool stuff. And I think that gets gets forgotten.
I'll tell you what, when I was going through some 2006 Colts tape, Walter was on it, obviously. It was him against Freeney.
Oh, man.
I was watching Walter Jones move, and I was like, there is nothing in the NFL that looks like that right now. Like, there's nothing. No. It's like Trent Williams, like prime Trent Williams is the only one. But I was looking at Walter move. I was like, this dude is in a three-point stance on third down, still getting to his landmarks, like with the most violent kick set I've ever seen. Like, there is nothing that looks like Walter Jones in the NFL. There's great tackle prospects all over the place. None of them are Walter. That dude was disgusting. So I think I will do a video on him. That'd be fun.
There you go. That's Brett Coleman. Thank you so much for coming on the show, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'd like to get your thoughts on what he said about the rest of the division and challenge you all to be as objective as possible and look at those lists of who the Cardinals, 49ers, Rams drafted. How do you feel about their classes? And I ask you this because I'm going to be diving into that over the next week or so on the channel. I've got creators lined up from all three opposing teams so that they can give us their view of how they think their teams drafted so that we can have a better understanding of what Seahawks may be up against from those draft classes as well as we head into the season. A lot going on over the next month and 2 months. Others may be slowing down because it's the quiet part of the off season. Not I. I will keep pushing forward because of your support. So thank you for watching the channel. Be sure to subscribe and do all those things. Until next time, follow me on Twitter @SeahawksForever. Forever and always, go Hawks.